Afghan authorities are preparing to deploy troops to retake a key border crossing seized by the Taliban as the group claims to be in control of 85% of the country. Another Ukrainian soldier is killed and three others wounded in fresh clashes in the rest of East. At least nine people are killed in a suicide car bomb attack in Somalia. Al-Shabaab militants claim responsibility for the attack. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us back to Afghanistan this hour, where Afghan authorities say they are preparing to deploy new troops to retake a key border crossing with Iran seized by the Taliban. A spokesman for the Herat governor said the troops will be soon dispatched to Islam Qala, a town along the border with Iran. The Taliban on Friday announced their fighters had captured the town. Now, the militant group also seized the Torgunde border port, a key crossing with Turkmenistan. The Taliban now claims to be in control of 85% of Afghanistan. However, Afghan authorities have dismissed that figure, pledging to retake all territory lost to the militants. The Taliban have increased their attacks on cities and villages since May, seizing dozens of rural districts. The fighting intensifies amid withdrawal of foreign forces from the country. The U.S. also announced its complete pullout by the end of August. The anti-Iran terror group known as the Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, opens its annual conference. Several members of the U.S. Congress are also scheduled to take part in the virtual meeting. Each year, the event brings together delegates paid by the terror group. Well, the MKO has conducted numerous acts of terror against Iranians. It has carried out assassinations and bombing campaigns since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, killing officials and thousands of civilians. The group also made a failed attempt on the life of Iran's Islamic Revolution leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the 1980s. The MKO has been delisted by the U.S. and the EU from their blacklist, despite the group's terror attacks and plots. During our news review program, we have discussed why the MKO still enjoys Western support, especially from the United States and France.
Joining us on this edition of the news review, we have Olsi Jajic, an Albanian historian and journalist, joining us from Kuala Lumpur. Also, we have Said Mosadabos, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Jazeshi in Kuala Lumpur. Give us your thoughts about how the Mujahideen Khalq organization still enjoys support from the likes of the United States and the European Union. As we can see, they are about to yet again open and conduct their annual conference in the French capital, Paris.
Their annual conference, as far as I'm aware, will be mainly directed from Albania, where MEK runs a paramilitary camp. The thing is that MEK is being used by Israeli secret services and certain groups in the United States to harass the security of Iran. They act in a way as a tool of American and Israeli imperialism against Iran. Many of the people who are going to speak in their conference today are diehard Israeli Zionists, people who support Israel and want the extinction of the Palestinian people. So MEK is being used in a way as a tool to pressure Iran to stop its support for Palestine. MEK is a terrorist organization. It is a failed organization. People who know what is going on with MEK in Albania, they know that many of their old terrorist members are dying. And moreover, MEK has big problems for its survival. It needs a big budget, which we suspect it comes from Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates. And the other problem is MEK has gross human rights violations. This is a cultish organization where it keeps slave soldiers, Iranians who have been handed to them since the war Iran-Iraq in the 1980s, 1990s, and many of their members are exploding. They want to abandon the organization. However, MEC, which has the support of the U.S. Embassy in Tirana, Albania, and in a way of the Albanian government, who is pressured by the Americans to support them, they are surviving. But this is their last breath. They cannot do anything to Iran. Iran is a powerful country, an independent country, and Iran is a big headache for European and Albanian security services. They organize human trafficking in Europe, money laundering. They have huge human rights violations within their organization. However, the propaganda that we hear by people who support MEC is that MEC is the organization that is going to bring democracy to Iran. However, MEC doesn't have democracy in its own organization. Its members are being kept as slave soldiers. They are not allowed to access internet, to have phones, to contact their families. And moreover, they are not allowed even to live in freedom. They live in a lockdown for the last 20 years. Many of those people, they do not know what happens in the world. They do not see TV. And I mean, this is a weird cultish organization. It is like Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS. And many of the people who support this organization, people from the late John McCain to John Bolton, are the very same people who supported jihadi and terrorist organizations against Syria.
Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, our guest in Kuala Lumpur, just named it all: money laundering, human trafficking, the cult-like behavior of the MKO as their members are treated as slaves. Why does this group still receive the support from the United States, from the EU? And also give us your thoughts about anything you would like to add to what our guest in Kuala Lumpur just said. He just mentioned that some of the U.S. officials that are supporting the MKO terrorist group are the same individuals who are supporting various other outfits of terror groups, specifically in the Middle East.
The hypocrisy of the Western nations, in particular Japan also actually in this instance, is mind-boggling, because they've essentially openly fated, supported, and encouraged this very, very openly terrorist organization. Yet, on the other hand, they've also been talking about fighting wars of terror around the world. So it's quite clear that the purpose of this particular organization, the MEK, is really for regime changes, as the West likes to put it, but basically to overthrow the Islamic Republic's democratic religious democracy, if you like. And the fact of the matter is that they've been supported since almost day dot of the Islamic Revolution. During the fall of 1981, the MEK was in charge of 65% of assassinations carried out in Iran. Approximately 1,000 officials from Imam Khomeini's establishment were killed just that summer alone, including killing of Aga Mohammed Bahshti, one of the foremost leaders of the revolution, I think the Speaker of the Parliament at that time. You know, judges, clerics, police officers, you know, all, nobody was spared. And after the Iran government had actually administered justice to many of these MEK members, they obviously calmed down to some extent, but their roots still exist in Iran, and the fact is they exist all over the world, and that's what's most useful to the US and to the Europeans, because they can try to use them as a destabilizing terrorism card. But they've lost all credibility in Islamic Republic of Iran. 17,000 plus are said to have been killed at their hands, probably a lot more than that now. That was just one figure from a few years back that I picked up. But of course, they have proven themselves to be traitors to Iran with their open siding with Saddam Hussein during the imposed war, the Zio-Western imperialist war, which teamed up with Saddam Hussein to invade Iran and then proceeded to kill hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iranians and cause huge bloodshed, the first the Gulf War, as it were. So the MEK have no credibility in Iran. They've been carrying out these assassinations even to this day, even the assassination of the nuclear scientist Ali Fakhrizadeh is said to have had MEK, involvement along with Mossad. So as my colleague said, they are effectively an extension of Zio or Anglo-Zionist deep state, and that's what they basically do, which is to continue killing, murdering, and maiming.
All right, thanks a lot. Olsi Jazeshi joining us from Kuala Lumpur. Also thanks to Sayed Mostanabo speaking to us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
And continuing with more news this hour, turning to Somalia, where at least 9 people have been killed in a suicide car bomb attack targeting a government convoy in the capital, Mogadishu. The convoy was carrying Mogadishu's police chief, Farhan Garodi, who survived the attack. Security officials say the casualties included police and civilians. 8 people were injured during the explosion that occurred at a busy intersection. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab terrorist group has claimed responsibility. Over a week ago, the group carried out an attack that killed 10 people and injured dozens of others in Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab, which is fighting to overthrow the internationally recognized government, regularly stages attacks against government and civilian targets in and around Mogadishu. And tensions are escalating in pro-Russia eastern Ukraine, where the army says another soldier was killed and 3 were wounded in fresh clashes. Soldiers have not sustained life-threatening wounds. Ukrainian positions on the front line have been targeted by artillery shells, mortars, grenade launchers, and machine gun fire. 4 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in fighting over the past week. The renewed clashes in eastern Ukraine have left the ceasefire brokered last year in tatters. Pro-Russia groups in eastern Donetsk and Lugansk regions declared independence in 2014, shortly after Russia incorporated the Crimean Peninsula. According to the United Nations, the ensuing conflict has claimed more than 13,000 lives. Well, Russia has reported 752 coronavirus fatalities during the last 24 hours. The figure pushed Russia's national death toll to more than 142,200. Russia also reported more than 25,000 new cases during the same period, pushing that tally to over 5.75 million. The capital, Moscow, and Russia's second largest city, St. Petersburg, remains hotspots of the new wave. Russia is battling a surge in the coronavirus cases. Now, authorities blame the spike on the more contagious Delta variant and the population's reluctance to get vaccinated. Well, the number of coronavirus deaths in Iran has surpassed 85,600, as the health ministry reports over 150 fatalities in a pace of 24 hours. Over 11,000 people also contracted the virus during the same period. That takes the total number of cases to over 3.3 million. Infections and deaths have been on the rise since the Delta variant emerged in some provinces in the southern part of Iran more than 2 weeks ago. Officials say the variant has been detected in central provinces, including Tehran. Also, they've called on citizens to abide by health protocols. Well, the latest wave of gun violence across the United States has renewed the debate on gun control in the country. Officials are taking measures to address the problem. Yet some Americans believe any further restrictions go against their Second Amendment rights.
Gun violence is killing more people in the U.S. state of New York than the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He announced on Thursday that he has declared gun violence in New York a disaster emergency making extra funding and resources available to combat shootings statewide. The first of its kind executive order came at a time when New York City and the country as a whole are struggling to curtail the spike in gun violence. Speaking during an event at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Cuomo said his plan includes short-term and long-term measures that treat gun violence as a public health crisis. Cuomo said nearly $139 million will be invested in prevention and employment programs to help youth and keep at-risk young people off the streets.
Fact, gun violence discriminates. The way COVID discriminated, gun violence discriminates. When you look among the victims of gun violence nationally, 59% non-white. New York State, 68% non-white. New York City, 77% non-white. Think about that, 77%.
Well, these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods and people are likely to be victims because crime is rampant in these communities. But why is crime rampant in these communities? Well, as we see and we know, poverty exacerbates not only just gun violence, but all sorts of violence, petty theft, nonviolent crimes, drugs, gang violence. These poor Black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Investigator Perry Kay jammed the brakes of his government-issued vehicle to survey the offense. Oh, this doesn't look too good. Let's take a peek, he said, exiting the car to handle what has become one of the most existential violations in drought-stricken Las Vegas, a faulty sprinkler. Perry Kay is one of nearly 50 water waste investigators deployed by the local water authority to crack down on even the smallest misuse of a liquid perilously scarce in western United States, desiccated by 2 decades of drought. The situation in Las Vegas, Nevada, which went a record 240 consecutive days without rain last year, is increasingly severe. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, "We Live in a Desert, We Have to Act Like It. Las Vegas Faces Reality of Drought." Stay with us for more of Oliver Millman's article. Investigator Perry Kay jammed the brakes of his government-issued vehicle to survey the offence. "Oh, this doesn't look too good. Let's take a peek," he said, exiting the car to handle what has become one of the most existential violations in drought-stricken Las Vegas, a faulty sprinkler. Perry Kay is one of nearly 50 water waste investigators deployed by the local water authority to crack down on even the smallest misuse of a liquid perilously scarce in western United States, desiccated by two decades of drought. The situation in Las Vegas, Nevada, which went a record 240 consecutive days without rain last year, is increasingly severe. Lake Mead, the vast reservoir that supplies Las Vegas with 90% of its water, has now plummeted to a historic low, meaning Nevada faces the first ever mandatory reduction in its water supply next year. This looming cutback is forcing restrictions upon the city that has somehow managed to thrive as a gaudy oasis in the baking Mojave Desert. "The lake isn't getting any fuller at this time, so we need to conserve every single drop of water," said Kay, an energetic former USF Force serviceman who wears a Vivis vest and brandishes a badge as he does his rounds, searching for violators. He starts his shift at 4 a.m. "A lot of people think because we are government workers, we are not out there at that time, but we are out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year," he said. Kay regularly hands out fines. They start at $80 and then double for each further offense, for the sort of rule-breaking he has spotted in Summerlin, a wealthy Las Vegas enclave where landscapers tend manicured grounds in the soaring heat. Water sprayed onto lawns and plants isn't allowed to flow off the property, but that day a damaged sprinkler had caused water to cascade into the gutter, where the precious resource is lost. "Look, we've got a little creek or stream here," said Perry Kay as he used his phone to video the water snaking onto the road. "If everyone did this, quite a bit of water would be wasted. It's so hot in Las Vegas. This July day's temperature will reach 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit, that the errant water will evaporate within 5 minutes. Perry Kay planted a yellow flag next to the leak as a warning to the homeowners, but a few taps on the computer mounted in his car shows this property has a previous warning, so an $80 fine will be on its way. There's a growing realization, however, that such rules, no watering between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m., none at all on Sundays, won't be sufficient, as Nevada is squeezed by a drought that has escalated dangerously in 2021. In June, the state passed a law to rip up non-functional public turf in Las Vegas, such as grass planted beside roads or on roundabouts, over the next 5 years to save around 10% of city water use. That is just wasteful. The only person who walks on that is the person who cuts it, said Kay, jabbing a finger at a nearby grass verge median. Some people just want to recreate home where they grew up with grass. The new law, along with a financial incentive given to homeowners to replace thirsty grass with more hardy desert plants and rocks, is an acknowledgement that climate change won't easily allow the imposition of a verdant green oasis upon a bone-dry desert basin. A city that contains a huge replica of the Eiffel Tower, sprawling golf courses, and a simulacrum of Venetian canals complete with gondolas can never be said to fit in with its surroundings. But Las Vegas, Nevada, called the Meadows in Spanish due to its natural springs that were pumped dry by the 1960s, is at least aware of its setting in a place so arid that only a few small creosote bushes and tumbleweeds can survive here naturally. We live in the desert. We are the driest city in the United States, in the driest state in the United States, said Colby Pellegrino, deputy manager of resources for the Southern Nevada Water Authority. We have to act like it. Colby Pellegrino said the recent escalation of the drought has been very scary for some Las Vegas residents, although she insists the Water Authority has planned for this moment. Lake Mead's level dropped under 1,075 feet in June, barely a third full, triggering what will be the first ever cutbacks under a seven-state agreement on sharing the water from the Colorado River, which is harnessed by the Hoover Dam to create the reservoir. Different states get different water allocations, and Nevada is a victim of its depopulated history, getting just 300,000 acre-feet of water a year. By comparison, California gets 4.4 million acre-feet of water under an agreement struck before the Hoover Dam was completed in the 1930s. The joke is that Nevada's representative was drunk, said Pellegrino, who was born in 1983, when the state's population was barely 900,000. It's now more than 3 million and receives tens of millions of tourists a year. The small water allocation will shrink by 21,000 acre-feet with the new cuts, although Nevada has made impressive strides in keeping below its low cap, slashing its water use despite the population nearly doubling since the early 2000s. Colby Pellegrino is confident that further savings can be made, and scrutiny is being placed upon the water used in Las Vegas' casinos' ubiquitous cooling systems. But global heating impact upon the West's snowpack and rivers is unrelenting, and the city's water savings will only go so far. Las Vegas only has a supporting role in its own fate. Three-quarters of allocated Colorado River water is used to irrigate thirsty agriculture, and the overall water supply is more dependent upon the amount of snow melting hundreds of miles away in the Rocky Mountains than some extra marginal savings made in the suburbs. Las Vegas has done great things such as ripping out the grass, but we've lost 20% of the flow of the Colorado River since 2000, and another 10% loss by 2050 is completely possible, said Brad Udall, a water and climate scientist at Colorado State University, whose research has focused on the stresses facing the Colorado River. I worry it could be even more than that, and that should frighten everyone. Back in Summerlin, Perry Kay is also relentless. A house opposite the first offender has broken sprinklers splurging water into the puddles on the grass and road. Perry Kay bangs on the ornate door to inform the homeowner, but no one is in. These sprinklers haven't popped up properly. They're just oozing everywhere, muttered Perry Kay. He has been policing water waste for the past 16 years, issuing countless fines in that time. I had hoped I would have worked myself out of a job by now, but it looks like I will retire first.
Africa Today.
Thousands of Ethiopians took to the streets to protest what they described as interference by the United States. During the May rallies in the capital Addis Ababa, the protesters filled the city's old stadium and the surrounding streets in a well-organized, peaceful demonstration dubbed Voices of Freedom and Sovereignty. The protesters had a clear message to the U.S. Hands off Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, my country, will proceed forward and won't go back. America should take its hands off us, and Egypt should refrain from the Nile Dam to show them that we Ethiopians will continue as a nation.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which brings you up-to-date analysis on African affairs. In our show today, we are focusing on Ethiopia's rejection of meddling by Western countries, especially the U.S., as it battles a rebel movement in the country's Tigray region. In the second segment of our program, we'll be talking about the recent parliamentary elections in Algeria as the country moves towards political stability. Now stay with us till the end of the show.
U.S. meddling in Ethiopia's Tigray. Ethiopia has been under increasing pressure from Western powers in connection with the situation in the country's Tigray region, where a rebel movement has taken up arms against the central government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered a ground and air military operation in Tigray in early November 2020 after accusing the region's then-governing party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, of orchestrating attacks on federal army camps, an allegation rejected by TPLF officials. The Prime Minister accused the TPLF of openly undermining his government.
Intent on perpetuating a culture of impunity and restoring the undue privilege they enjoyed in the past, the TPLF old guards have continuously mounted both covert and overt attempts to undermine the people of Ethiopia in our new administration.
The Ethiopian military, aided by Eritrean troops, has been battling forces loyal to the TPLF for nearly 8 months. According to some reports, Western countries, including the United States, are backing the TPLF rebels. The conflict has killed thousands of people and many more, triggering an immense humanitarian crisis. The United States has seen the conflict in Tigray as an opportunity to meddle in Ethiopia's internal affairs and has announced sanctions against this Horn of Africa nation. Ethiopians held a massive rally in the country's capital, Addis Ababa, to condemn U.S. interference in the country's internal affairs. Addressing the rally, Addis Ababa Mayor Adanech Abebe said Ethiopia will never kneel down to the U.S.
The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region risks heightening tensions surrounding the country's hydroelectric power project. the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Negotiations over the dam with neighboring countries, Sudan and Egypt, have stalled and could be delayed further while the Ethiopian government responds to the ongoing crisis. Now, for more on the situation in Ethiopia, we have contacted Farema Alim, a senior Kenyan politician and an expert on Horn of Africa affairs. Thank you very much, Mr. Maalim, for your time.
Thank you.
Now, our first question. Ethiopians are protesting against U.S. interference in the country's ongoing Tigray conflict. What's the extent of this meddling, and what are the interests of Washington in this conflict?
Washington has a very powerful, very deep-rooted and old interest in Ethiopia and in the Horn of Africa in general, but in particular in Ethiopia, because for close to 30 years, the TPLF regime that controlled Ethiopia had worked as a surrogate, as a kind of the blue-eyed boys of the American foreign policy in Africa. And they were playing the role that Israel plays for America in the Middle East. They were playing it for the Horn of Africa. And so when you lose such a powerful ally who does all the biddings for you, it is costly, and they would want them back. But not because of the interest of Ethiopia or the interest of the continent, the wider continent, or the Horn of Africa. That is purely for American strategic interest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farema Alim, for that insight.
Eritrea's foreign minister has blamed the U.S. for the current conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region. Eritrea says U.S. administrations supported the Tigray People's Liberation Movement, or the TPLF, for over two decades. In a letter to the UN Security Council, Eritrean Foreign Minister Usman Saleh accused President Joe Biden's administration of stoking further conflict and destabilization through interference and intimidation in the region, apparently to resuscitate the remnants of the TPLF regime. As we have seen, Eritrea has also blamed the U.S. for destabilization in Ethiopia's Tigray region, what prompted the authorities in Asmara to issue the statement.
And the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which also controlled Ethiopia through the EPRDF, had waged a war against Eritrea. That was a very costly war in which they wanted to recapture Eritrea and exercise that hegemony. And that was also done with the tacit approval, the support, the financing, and all the elements of the Americans and the Western countries for that purpose. So Eritrea sees the meddling of the Horn of Africa by America and its Western allies and has seen it from the beginning. It maintained its own independence, small as it may be. It is the only country that has stood firm and that has said a no, a big no with a capital N, to that meddling. Right now, the Americans are trying to revive the TPLF again. You don't forget, Americans gave billions and billions of dollars in aid to TPLF, which is not accountable.
The TPLF led the coalition that ruled Ethiopia for nearly 30 years until Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed rose to power in 2018. He further alienated the TPLF by making peace with longtime foes Eritrea as soon as he took office. Abiy Ahmed won the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for his peacemaking efforts, which ended two decades of hostility with longtime enemy Eritrea. This is what he had to say on reconciliation with Eritrea.
I believed peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea was within reach. I was convinced that the imaginary wall separating our two countries for much too long needed to be torn down. And in its place, a bridge of friendship, collaboration, and goodwill has to be built to last for ages. That's how I approached the task of building peace, a peace bridge, with my partner, President Isaias Afwerki. We were both ready to allow peace to flourish and shine through.
Eritrea says that the U.S. wants to resuscitate the remnants of the TPLF regime, which ruled Ethiopia for nearly 30 years. Now, does this imply that the U.S. is at odds with the current government of Abiy Ahmed?
The gains that were done by Abiy Ahmed. Abiy Ahmed has done, has made massive strides and massive gains in the interest of the people of Horn of Africa in the wider sense. That includes Eritrea and Somalia, and also in the interest of the Ethiopian people themselves. I mean, that is not something that Americans would be happy with. Americans don't care what happens to the populations of any country. You've seen what they did in Libya. You've seen what they've done in Iraq. You've seen what they've done in Syria. You've seen what they're doing right now using their own other machinery terrorists, what you call government, that they prop up in the Gulf states in the name of the Emirates and the Saudis to Yemen. So they don't care what happens to the 125 million Ethiopians. They only care about their own interests. And this bunch of a small minority that they have been using all this time to do the bidding for them. And it's precisely because of that that they want to bring them back. But they can't bring them back. Ethiopians are known to resist any form of domination.
Now, Western countries are accusing Ethiopia of using starvation as a weapon of war. Ethiopia's UN ambassador, Tai Atsike Selesi Amdi, has categorically rejected these accusations.
When someone label us that we are using starvation as an instrument of weapon or war, it indeed pains us. It brings back a terrible memory of hunger. So, if, as I said in the council, if we did it, of course, we will definitely carry the albatross around our neck. The guilt will be on us.
The United States envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, recently issued a thinly veiled threat against Ethiopia by stating that it is time to move from analysis to action regarding Tigray. Now, Mr. Farah, the Biden administration recently appointed Jeffrey Feltman as the first U.S. special envoy to the Horn of Africa. Do you expect to see more meddling by the U.S. in this volatile and strategic region?
They will do a lot of meddling. They will create all the conflicts that they can create. American foreign policy in Africa and in other third world countries like the Middle East triumphs or operate or escalate always violence and destruction of state and society, disintegration of state and society. And wherever they went, that's what they did. And they intend to do that also, but I don't think they're going to succeed this time. The African continent has come out of these things wiser. And they know that the Americans are not interested in the African people themselves. They're only interested in the resources and the strategic position of these countries that are in the Horn of Africa. So they will continue meddling, but I don't think they can go far. They tried to meddle in the internal affairs of Eritrea for many years, for about 30 years now, and they lost. So Eritrea and Ethiopia now has also woken up to the realization, and they have a good leader in the name of Abiy Ahmed, who cares about his people, who cares about his continent, who cares about his wider region of Horn of Africa.
Thank you for that, Mr. Farah Maalim.
The situation in Tigray has raised concern that the meddling by Western powers is meant to trigger the disintegration of Ethiopia, which is one of Africa's fastest-growing economies. Some experts believe it could soon reach middle-income status.
Now, our last question, are Western countries pursuing a policy to balkanize Ethiopia by backing the TPLF, which is pursuing a secessionist agenda?
They will pursue this secessionist idea to the extent of empowering them to take over again power at the center in Addis Ababa. I don't think the Americans really want to create small countries in Ethiopia. No. They want to use them right now as a secessionist movement, but the ultimate objective, the same way when the TPLF came to power, they came in as the Tigray People's Liberation Front and were agitating to secede from Ethiopia, but they never seceded from Ethiopia because they realized they had an opportunity right now to use the resources of that country and to basically brutalize it the way they brutalized it for all those years. And I think the Americans also want to use them to do the same again, roll back again into Addis Ababa, take over the reins of power using the tanks and the weapon and the resources and then all that's given to them by America and its own other machinery surrogates like the leadership right now in Egypt.
Now, thank you very much, Mr. Farah Maalim, Horn of Africa Affairs Expert, for your insight on the situation in Ethiopia. Now, we shall take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the recent parliamentary elections in Algeria. Stay with us.
A Algeria moving towards stability.
Algeria's former ruling party, the FLN, won most seats in the June parliamentary elections. Now, the early election was supposed to exemplify President Abdelmadjid Tebboune's new Algeria with an emphasis on young candidates and those outside the political elite. Now, this is what the president had to say in February when he dissolved the previous parliament.
لتكون خالية من المال سواء كان فاسد وغير فاسد تفتح أبوابها للشباب وقلت
Following the June elections, Algeria's FLN, long the country's biggest political party, won the most seats in the parliamentary election. The FLN's 105 seats were far short of the 204 needed to secure a majority in the 407-seat parliament, with the Islamist MSP winning 64 seats. FLN's victory surprised many observers who had written off the party due to its links with former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Young people in Algeria have praised new electoral laws which presented them with opportunities.
The vote was held successfully despite a boycott by the long-running Hirak protest movement. Now, for more analysis on the recent elections in Algeria, we contacted Sami Hamdi, the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Thanks a lot, Mr. Hamdi, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Mr. Hamdi, will the new parliament support President Abdelmadjid Tebboune's program as Algeria moves towards stability and progress?
The parliament and the role of these elections was to create some sort of legitimacy where legitimacy did not exist before. It was about filling this political vacuum that was left behind by the fall of Bouteflika and the absence of any renewed elected body. It's important to remember that the parliament before the elections was the parliament from the Bouteflika regime and not a parliament truly representative of the Hirak movement. Your question is that the parliament will go along with Tebboune.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamdi, for that insight.
Analysts say significant changes were made in the elections that cannot be underestimated, most notably the rise in civilian nominees amongst all the leading parties. The new changes include the Movement of Society for Peace bloc and the National Construction Movement, which will bring about some sort of balance in the political scene and in parliament. Algerians also had high hopes while going to the polls. An older voter expressed his optimistic outlook.
Now, Mr. Hamdi, in your opinion, will the parliamentary elections make a difference in the country?
I think it depends. I think it's important to stress that the regime is trying to steamroll the popular protest, not necessarily because it is entirely against the popular protest, but because there are certain fears and legitimate fears, if we're speaking objectively, that it has if these protests continue for an extended period of time. The first fear is that it gives rise to the separatist tendencies that the Algerian government is especially sensitive to. These separatist tendencies, the Amazigh, the Barbar, we've seen more of their flags being waved in the Hirak movement, and we've seen that the overwhelming boycott of the elections actually took place in those regions. There was whole region-wide boycott of the elections from the Amazigh regions, and the government fears that if the protests keep continuing, then France is going to support some sort of separatism, which it would be happy to do so in order to weaken Algeria.
Well, a very interesting angle there by Mr. Hamdi, that France might be interfering in Algeria's internal affairs by supporting protesters and others who boycotted the elections in the country. Algeria actually cancelled the accreditation of France 24 a day after the June parliamentary elections. The government said the move was due to the satellite news channel's clear and repeated hostility towards Algeria and its institutions.
The outlet said authorities had given the channel a final warning on March 13th over its coverage of Friday marches of the long-running Hirak anti-government protest movement. Ammar Belhima, the communications minister and government spokesperson, told the Algeria official news agency that France 24 fail to respect journalistic rules and ethics, saying it practices disinformation and manipulation in addition to confirmed hostility against Algeria. What will be the fate of the Hirak movement after the elections? Will it support Wayne?
I think the awkward thing about the Hirak is that the people who are participating in the Hirak have always boasted that their plus point or their positive point is they have no leadership, which has always baffled me and confused me, and it's one of the reasons why they've been unable to really translate their gains into tangible political gains that might actually be reflected in the parliament or even reflected in politics generally. But also it's important to talk realities in that the Hirak itself is badly divided, and that's primarily because it's easy to unite to bring down a regime such as the Bouteflika regime, because Bouteflika was the lightning rod. The reality is everybody has their own opinion. You have separatist tendencies, you have leftist tendencies, you have pro-Islam tendencies, you have nationalist tendencies that are unable to see eye to eye, and I think this is one of the reasons that the Hirak has been unable to essentially translate itself into some sort of political party that can actually dominate the parliament.
The recent parliamentary election in Algeria had one major difference from previous elections, and that was the much larger number of independents winning seats in parliament. Algerians voted for the independent candidates with high expectations. Now, this young Algerian voter believes the new parliamentarians will bring the much needed change. Mr. Hamdi, our last question. Why have we seen an increase in the number of independents? Now, does this imply that voters have no trust in political parties?
It is the prevalent opinion, and people like this idea of I am independent, I am not associated with a party, I am not associated with a particular faction, I am not associated with a particular ideology, because the connotations and the implications are so strong in the Algerian subconscious. And this is why a lot of independents, while they ran as independents, they were aligned somewhat to different parties, but didn't say that openly because they were worried about how that would be received by the Algerian people. The reality is also that the political culture in Algeria, and indeed in the North African countries, is still not necessarily at a level whereby they can differentiate between the various different political parties. There's still this sensationalism whereby everybody is corrupt, everybody is bad, everybody's in it for their self-interest. Whereas if you were to apply a more nuanced approach and actually look at the realities on the ground, I think there are very sincere individuals who actually engage with the political process in order to try to achieve something.
Thank you very much, Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest. Now, unfortunately, our time is up for today. Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you, and don't forget to drop us a line through our social media handle. Until next time, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.